So I thought we'd turn our attention towards reactivity. Because in order for us to begin to see in a subtler way the experience of anger, aversion, all of this stuff we're talking about, we have to see the distinction between reactivity and what's human condition, what's human nature, or what, the gift, I guess you could say, of anger itself. There's a way that you can look at it. You can think of it as there's two levels here. There's a gross level and there's a subtle level. On the gross level, you're looking at your reactivity itself, how you are manifesting your response to some unpleasantness. It's unpleasantness in the body. It's unpleasantness in a situation. It's unpleasantness in thinking. But somehow on this grosser level, you are reacting to that unpleasantness and that gross level of reactivity is what we normally see. On a subtle level, you're paying attention to the tensions, what's actually happening in the body, the flesh, the fullness of the fulling the what do you call it, the flush of the face, or you might feel tingling, or you might feel some bodily experience. And that bodily experience is a much more subtle kind of attention that we're learning to pay attention to. It's less obvious than our reactivity, the gross level reactivity, but it's still a reactive experience that we're having. What I found when I started practicing is that I would get caught in the gross level reactivity, and I would ignore the tensions and the more subtler reactivity. And what I think Rodney, my teacher, was trying to get me to do was to pay attention to the subtler reactivities, the subtler tensions that were arising in the body, to begin to learn how this habit of aversion or hatred got attached to normal moments of anger or normal moments in time that had an emotional experience. Ultimately, what I learned was that that my anger was always tied to sadness and disappointment. That I basically did not get mad at anything unless I thought I was going to be disappointed or I thought it was going to make me sad. And that I would impulsively get angry first. So that time I was mad at my nephew for not, for, the kitchen being so dirty. I was really disappointed that I had to clean up the kitchen. That's what happened. It wasn't anger at anything. It was just, I did not want to feel disappointed. And I think that comes from the way I was raised. I was raised around so much disappointment that when we get older and we think we're in control of our lives, I'll do anything to keep from feeling that disappointment. So let me start by kind of putting this in a softer context from Mary Oliver. This poem she wrote is what we're going to talk about, practice with this afternoon. It's called The Wasp. And I think Mary Oliver, man, she is the mindfulness or practitioner's poet. Because some of her poetry is so mindful driven. It's so much mindfulness in it that it helps us see into something that we're trying to see almost better than listening to the suttas themselves. So this is one example I think of this. It's called the wasp. And she says, why the wasp was on my bed, I didn't know. Why I was in bed, I did know. Why there wasn't room for both of us, I didn't know. I watched it idly. Idleness can be a form of dying. I did know that. The wasp didn't communicate how it felt. It did look confused on the white sheet, as though it had landed somewhere in the Arctic. And it did flick its wings when I raised my leg, causing an upheaval. I didn't want to be lying there. I didn't want to be going in that direction. And so I say it was a gift when it rose into the air and, as wasps do, expressed itself in a sudden and well-aimed motion. Almost delicious was its deep, inflexible sting. Now think about this for a moment. Two things are happening here. And this poem to me points to the two things that are happening when we get angry. The one thing is there's an automatic kind of response that the wasp does without thinking when she raised her leg, right? That is the nature of true anger. It is co-arising. It's dependent origination at its core. It's very simple. It arises in some moment of time, some upheaval. But then there is a kind of storyline about all of this. There's a story, there's a thing that's going on. And I think what I like about this poem in relation to anger is all the I knows and I don't know. I knew I was in the bed. I knew why. I don't know why the wasp was here. I did know that idleness is a problem. This kind of the story of it and the I didn't want to be laying there. I didn't want this situation to happen. I didn't want to go in this direction. I wanted to get up. So this is a simple thing, but it points to a great way to begin to open up to the idea of getting to know reactivity. Because reactivity is an impulsive kind of response. And yet, that's what we have to practice with. That's what we have to begin to see more clearly is the nature of that reactivity. Let me see, there's some other notes I have here. So oftentimes, I have a friend who's a monk with Thich Nhat Hanh, with the Utejan Nias group. And he always tells me about practice. He gives me these little practice clues. And he's what's considered, well, I don't know if he still is, but he was back when I knew or seen him a lot more. He was like a wandering monk. So he went from one place to another place to another place whenever somebody bought him a ticket and let him go somewhere. And he actually told me that he goes to the airport and Asian people know, I would just say Asian people just because they were only Asians, he said, that did this for him. But they know that if a monk's in an airport, they need to get somewhere. And so they will buy him a ticket. So he would go to the airport if he needed to try to get to someplace and people would help him get a ticket. That's how he got around. Or he would just go wherever homeless people go or wherever they let you eat or whatever. He would just go to places where he could be offered something. What he couldn't do is ask me to buy him a ticket to get to some place. And so I just thought it was such a, I mean, what would that be like if we actually saw a monk in an airport? Would we walk up to them and say, do you need a ticket somewhere? Can I buy you a ticket somewhere? I'd never have done anything like that. I couldn't even imagine walking up to someone and doing something like that. But that was his experience, that Asian people would walk up to him and ask him if he needed to go somewhere. But he was trying to help me understand how to practice in an ordinary sense without some, you know, we in the West have treated practice almost like I gotta go somewhere and sit down and meditate. And if I'm not meditating, I'm not practicing. But he was trying to help me see, you know, how to practice in everyday life. And so what he said was, he asked me, what does it mean if I like something? And of course I was like, I like something. He asked me, what does it mean if I don't like something? I don't like it. You know, I don't really know. He goes, no, you're practicing. When you practice at the level of I like or I don't like, you're practicing at the level of greed and hatred. There is no I like and I don't like. Let's just take a moment and get that. There is no I like, I don't like. There's nothing inherently wrong with peas, but how come my son doesn't like them? It's personal. It's just his thing. He doesn't like them. I used to try to sneak him in carrots because he really liked carrots. I tried to sneak him in and he would eat around the peas. He didn't like them. If he saw a little green ball, he didn't want it. And yet I love them. Or there was a time when I would never eat beets because I thought beets were like my mom's, like red things. But somebody made a beet salad that was so good. And I went to her and I said, what kind of salad is this? There's something in here that I really like. And I showed her the little fruit or the little, you know, vegetable. What is this? She goes, a beet? I said, that's not a beet. I know what beets are. That's not a beet. She's like, yes, that's a beet. It was a real beet. It wasn't the canned or whatever those beets were, pickled beets my mother used to eat. I couldn't believe it. I didn't realize that beets were so good. I didn't realize that beets were something other than what I thought it was. But I thought about all the years that I would never let myself eat beets because I thought as soon as I was going to eat it, it would taste like the beets that were in the cans that my mom used. Or some people love dark chocolate, and the darker the better. Ooh, they love it. I hate it. It's so bitter. But in my mind, it looks like chocolate. It looks like milk chocolate. So when I taste it, my mind always expects it to be sweet like milk chocolate. And it's very bitter. And it's like, that's not chocolate. I don't know what that is. This is what I'm trying to get us to see with reactivity. Reactivity is placing a subjective opinion on a neutral experience. The experience itself is not what makes something pleasant, unpleasant, or neither. It's our subjective opinion on that that makes it good, bad, or indifferent. So one more example. I was at this retreat with my friend, the monk, and I love him. And we were sitting there doing this practice together. And we were supposed to be thinking about feeling tones and practicing with feeling tones. And it was an inside dialogue retreat. So we were going to talk about it with each other. So I am sitting there describing, it took me all week to get a sit with him. So I am describing how much I like, you know, how I felt so much pleasant, and I'm feeling this pleasant. I'm feeling this happiness. I know he's happy. We're both happy to be together. Everything is wonderful. The sun is out. It's just a perfect moment in time. And then it was his turn. And he started talking about how he didn't want to be there. He was in pain. He hated this. Why did he think to do this? His body is not cooperating. And he was miserable. And I remember having this moment inside me that said, no, you're not. I heard myself inside saying, no, you're not. You're happy. We're having a good time. I could not mentally separate my feeling tone from the outer experience. Can you see what I'm pointing to here? So if we're going to begin to work with anger, aversion in any way, we have to work with the feeling tones. We have to learn to experience the feeling tones, which is why the Buddha pointed to the feeling tones as the second foundation of mindfulness. The feeling tones are both a physical feeling and a mental activity of mind at the same time. And what we are learning to do is calm the mental reactivity of our feeling tones. Where this is what helps us calm aversion, is the mental activity of our feeling tone. Think this. Every single experience that we have, the mind puts an automatic tag on it. This is a pleasant experience, an unpleasant, a neither. We do not put that tag on it. So the tag gets put on by the mind. And we cannot stop the mind from putting the tag on it. You don't know whether you're going to be the person that likes Brussels sprouts or not. You don't know. You don't know when you taste it. Somehow, when you taste it, it could be the conditions under which you taste it. I don't know. You could have been in a bad mood. Mama put the Brussels sprouts there. They were too hot. They were too cold. I don't know. She cooked them too soft and mushy. She didn't cook them long enough. Could have been Daddy cooked them. And usually Mama cooks and now Daddy cooks and he put this thing on there. Who knows what created that moment in time when your mind put a tag on this experience. We begin to think that the tag is the truth of the experience, but it is not. The truth of the experience is that you're eating. That's it. But the tagging that goes along with eating becomes something that we begin to live out of. And as we live out of it, we get more and more and more concretized around what is supposed to be and what is not supposed to be. And we're living in a world where we're forced, shoved into spaces where we have to live out experiences that we aren't supposed to live out. It's not supposed to be like that. And so now we are trapped in a world where there's all these experiences that we believe should not be, and we have to have them. Can you see why our reactivity is getting bigger and bigger and bigger? So the experience itself is what leads to this reactivity. It's just the nature of phenomena. It is the mental tag that the mind puts on everything. Everything. But if the mind puts a tag that something is not pleasant, then we cannot tolerate it. We cannot hold it. We cannot be with it. We do not want it. I think in the world, the way it was, you know, in historical times, we lived in smaller communities, but I think we were more intimate with the truth of people's lives. So, you knew less people, but you were intimate about what was happening to people. But the world is getting so much bigger, so much complex, so much wider, that we have less relationship and more of the felt sense of people's experience. So we are feeling more and more and more and more and more and more and more, but we have less content around it and less ability to do anything, change anything, offer any help. It's just getting more and more and more complicated. So the mind keeps creating all these feeling tones that tell us, oh, you should stop that. You should do something about that. You need to fix that. And we have less and less and less capacity to make a difference. This is why I think it's getting harder and harder and harder to be in a world where we're so reactive, and our reactivity is not going anywhere. It's not making a difference. It's not doing anything. We just get more and more and more reactive. I have to find it on the break when we do our walking. But there's a sutta where the Buddha describes the world that existed at his time. Let me see if I can find it now. I really don't want to talk. Let me see if I can find it. Give me a second. Probably not. Maybe I'll find it and I'll bring it tomorrow. That's what I'll do. I'll bring it tomorrow. That's better. So I'll just describe it. He described what the world was like in his time. It's remarkably simple, similar to the world we live in. And when I heard this sutta, I realized that I had been kind of dismissing the nature of the world that the Buddha decided to get awakened in. Because I kind of treated that world like it was simple, right? Softer, not complicated like it is now. Now it's really, 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 really complicated. It's not so easy to just go sit under a tree and get enlightened, awakened or something. Now it's a much more difficult world, complicated world, but it's not. We live in the same world. That's why I want to read it to you. We live in the exact same world. But what Buddha understood, or he came to understood, is that our liberation is not going to come from figuring out how to make the world a better place. It doesn't mean that we don't try to make the world a better place, but not out of that's our liberation. We try to make the world a better place out of kindness to human beings. But our liberation is tied to letting go of this reactivity, calming the mental reactivity around phenomena, such that we are actually free to choose how we want to be in a moment. We can choose whether or not this unpleasantness is something I need to deal with, or is this unpleasantness something I just need to hold for a moment and let it pass? We have to choose that, because the natural phenomena of mind is when there is an unpleasantness, this needs to be fixed. We need to do something about it. And we need to do something about it now. But when we allow for the natural arising of unpleasantness, when I don't like something, the way Mary Oliver allowed for the wasp to sting, understanding that that is just inherently part of what happens. If you disrupt the wasp. That allowing phenomena to happen in our lives gives us the capacity to choose how we're going to relate to it. But this requires that we start practicing with feeling tones and our reactivity around feeling tones. That's all we're practicing. We're not actually practicing anything else. Even though I said this was an anger workshop, I knew it was going to take a while just till I could get you to a place where you could see that it really is your don't likes, likes, and you're ignoring what you think is not a big deal. This is what we're practicing with. So oftentimes, I found that I would have this moment where something happened and I could suck it up, right? I think this is sort of what we were talking about this morning. I could suck it up. I could deal with it. I know how to handle it. And my coping skills were good enough that I didn't have to worry about it. And then all of a sudden, the coping skills stop working and I can't suck it up. And now things are coming at me and things were getting overloaded. And that's why I went to my teacher. But what my teacher was pointing to is this was always coming. It was always going to come to a point where I wasn't going to be able to control it. I just didn't know that. We go through this social life of learning to control our emotions, keep them squished down. Don't let anybody see them. Don't let them get out of control. And that is not what Buddha was pointing to. Buddha was pointing to turning our attention inward, seeing our own experience in a moment, being able to just know, oh, this is really unpleasant. Hold on a minute. Hold on. Not going to do anything. Just a minute. Let me see. What makes it unpleasant? How did that happen? It's just a thing that's happened. How come it's so unpleasant to me? You got to be interested in that. You got to want to know, how come this is unpleasant to you? How come this is so pleasant to you? How come I went through the whole day and I don't even remember what happened? What happened? I just kind of went through and then the whole day passed by. How come? This is not you. It's not me. It's what happens when we let the mind, this ordinary mind, with its ordinary reactivity, go through life ahead of us without mindfulness. This is why the Buddha pointed to mindfulness. This is why we're practicing. Not so we can get calm. I mean, there is some calm that comes, but you know, we're practitioners. I know already most of you like rarely get a calm sit. It's like it's kind of like a, whoa, that shit was good. What happened? What did I do? How did I make that happen like that? Mostly we're struggling just to stay still. We're struggling just to pay attention. So calm is something that comes, but it's not necessarily a game changer. What's a game changer is when you begin to realize how much choice you actually have in any given moment, because every single experience that arises in and of itself is completely and 100% manageable. It's completely and 100% holdable. It's completely and 100% capable of providing great wisdom. Any experience at any time, under any circumstances. I'm talking about from getting up and going to the toilet where we're going to go in just a couple of minutes to, sitting on a retreat 10 days in and having this mind-blowing moment of samadhi. There's no difference in those moments except to the mind. And so we want to know, how do we make those kind of choices? How does the mind make those kind of choices? Where does it come from? And when we get interested in that, more so than what we get stuck in anger, then the anger, which is just reactivity, will be the least of our concerns. It's way down the line. By the time we get to anger, we've already gotten stuck in the reactivity. So we want to bring the pendulum, bring the view closer to the moment when I began to get interested in my mind's opinions about what is pleasant, what is unpleasant, what is neither. That's what we're going to kind of look at this afternoon. Another reflection by Ian McCrory. The Dhamma is not a way out of our problems, but a way into them. In our problems, we realize the futility of thinking. In our problems, we experience the pain of the human condition. In our problems, we see the cause of misery. And in our problems, we see that we are that cause. The Dhamma takes us into this moras and through it. The Dhamma is more bridge than detour. That's what we're going to do. The Dhamma is our way of actually seeing and uncovering and experiencing the truth of this human reactivity. So let us find a comfortable place to settle into our practice. Get a sense of seclusion, a sense of turning away from the doings of our life or this moment or just the thinking mind's ordinariness, a kind of turning into this body, this moment, this sort of opportunity to practice. And you can just feel the body sitting here, arriving in this present moment, right here. You can feel this sense of being together. It's like turning your mind towards now. Even if there's thinking, you can still turn your attention to the felt sense of sitting here now, this moment. Really get a sense that you know where you are. I'm right here, and I can feel myself sitting or lying down. I feel it. You might even feel the body settling as you pay attention. The body knows how to settle and soften into the moment. We just turn our attention away from the outside world towards this inner world. And when we turn our attention inward, that's when we actually have a capacity to see and experience more. This is how the Dhamma is the bridge to help us see. And then we want to be available for whatever arises. So we don't have to make the moment be any way in particular. We just want to be available. What that means is all that is asked of me is to be willing to sit here for the duration of practice. That's it. Sit here and watch what arises. Notice what arises. And what's the felt sense of that? It doesn't have to be a certain type of a rising, or as Philip Moffat always says, we're just practicing practice. We're not practicing getting to a certain result. So with this being available, being open, we need the protection of the Dhamma as a guide. So we align our moment of being open to the Dhamma, meaning we want to see the nature of suffering, see where suffering is, see where it's not, see what leads to suffering, what doesn't lead to suffering. We want to understand the nature of human condition. Not trying to fix anything, not trying to make the moment be a certain way, just aligning with the truth of the Four Noble Truths, that if we learn to see suffering, we will learn to see the cause of suffering, and we will learn to see the cessation of suffering. So we're here in this seclusion, tucked in, available for whatever arises, aligned with the Dhamma. We can rest our attention on the body. Just notice its heavy hardness of sitting here. It's firm, it's earth element. It's solid right here, relatively still. Just sitting here or lying here. And there's nothing else I need to do. I don't have to make the body feel a certain way. It's the earth, regardless of how it feels. You can ground in the lower portion of the body, in the pelvic. And feel the heaviness of the sit bones, the pull of gravity, just this felt sense of the stability of earth. And when we get still with the foundation of earth, we can always notice the movement that's happening. No matter how subtle breathing is, when we feel the earth of this body, we can notice the movement of breath. It's very subtle. Very slight, or we just let it be there. This is wind. And the movement, the tingling, the shifting, the changing, this is what happens in life. It moves, shifts, changes. So we are learning to feel the stability of this body, the natural movement of life. We have it here. And then we're going to add the felt sense of fire. And fire is this vast array of temperatures, from the very cold to hot. It's coolness and warm and all in between. So see in your experience, are there parts of your body that's feeling cold right now? Just a felt sense of cold. You don't have to do anything about it, but you might can feel the temperature of cold, or it might be just cool. You might have other parts of the body where it feels warm or hot. Everything, every phenomena, every experience has a temperature to it. Just as it has feeling tones, it has temperature. If it's too cold, we immediately want to fix that and make it warm. If it's too hot, we immediately want to fix that, make it colder. If it's too intense, we want to fix that, make it more subtle. Or if it's too subtle, we want to fix that, make it more. We're constantly trying to adjust the temperature of our experience. And here we're just practicing feeling the temperature and letting it be however it is. Body is still, grounded in earth, here and now. It's alive with wind and movement, and we can notice the fluctuating temperature of fire. Just notice how the temperature changes, how you don't like certain temperatures, and what the mind does when it doesn't like something, how much it wants to fix and correct. But our practice is learning to just be here with the temperature as fire, nothing to do about it. You may notice the temperature of a sensation. You may notice the temperature of a sound. You may notice the temperature of the body itself, various parts of it. But noticing temperature keeps us from getting too engaged with the content and the story. And we can begin to see how the feeling tones of liking and not liking push us into moving and towards action. We are learning how to be with the temperature of phenomena, the temperature of experience, so that we can choose whether to move. I may be cold right now, but I can choose whether I move to adjust the shawl or adjust my body or tighten up or loosen up. You may be hot right now, and you can choose whether to move or to just let it be and see what it's like to be too hot or too cold. Temperature is a good place to practice with reactivity. Are you still present here now in this moment, noticing the earth of the body, heavy, hard, and firm here, grounded, relatively still, and the movement of wind and the temperature? If you get lost in thought, you notice that you're gone, consider the temperature of where you were. Was it cool or hot? Cool or warm? Is it connected to a sensation? And is that sensation cool or warm or hot or cold? Consider the temperature of experience. What does that mean? The Dhamma is not a way out of our problems, but a way into them. In our problems, we realize the futility of thinking. In our problems, we experience the pain of the human condition. In our problems, we see the cause of misery, and in our problems, we see that we are that cause. The Dhamma takes us into this moras and through it. The Dhamma is more bridge than detour. So for this walking period, we're going to find something that is an example of an experience where we had a moment of anger or something that we think of as anger. You want to see if you can recall the moment with as much detail as you can, who said what and what was done. It doesn't have to be the most complicated, most difficult, traumatic moment. It can be something simple. But see if you can notice the temperature. Notice how you experience that moment, what the experience of it is. And then see if you can see the harm, either to you or the harm to someone else, but can you see or feel into what that harm is and what the temperature is of that? So we just want to see, recall a moment, and still, I would suggest that we do this by doing something. While we're doing something, recall a moment where we felt like we were angry, and not an anger where someone's angry at us, but a moment where we were angry, and then feel into the details of it. See if we can feel the harm of it. See if we can feel the temperature of it. And then I'll ring the bell in 20 minutes and we can come back. Good things start and bad things stop. The greatest aid is being still. Stop trying to start the good and start trying to not stop the bad. No starting, no stopping. Only ever progressing stillness. So to make good things start and bad things stop, the greatest aid is being still. Sorry about that. To make good things start and bad things stop, the greatest aid is being still. Stop trying to start the good and start trying to not stop the bad. No starting, no stopping, only ever progressing stillness. So let us come back into seclusion and let go of everything that's in the mind. You know, the mind wants to continue to ruminate on what it has thought about. We're not going to try to stop its rumination. We're not going to try to start a level of stillness. We're just going to notice, eyes closed, with the proprioceptive awareness, we know where we are. We know we're still. We know we're sitting in a chair. We know we're here in this moment. We just want to feel into that. Just actually turn our attention towards the felt sense of seclusion. We can actually feel seclusion. We can let go of things outside our ordinary life and just feel into this moment of practice. It's like turning inward is what it actually is. Turning inward towards feeling our way into the moment. So we feel the groundedness of the body. We always arrive here first with the body. Getting a sense of its stillness, its steadiness, its heavy hardness, the earth of it, and feeling the earth, not just this kind of intellectual way, but we can actually feel the groundedness of earth by feeling into the heavy and hardness of the body. That's how we can get aligned, a willingness to let whatever arise, arise. I'm not trying to make this moment any way different. If the mind wants to continue to talk about whatever it was thinking about or contemplating, that's fine. But we can still turn our attention towards the body. So we're available for whatever arises. We're aligned with the Dhamma to see what can be known in relation to suffering. And we use the earth as a means to ground us here. We always want to open to wind and its movement as a way of acknowledging feel the temperature, feel the heat or the coolness of the moment, the coldness. We want to add one more element here. You can sense into the body as a spacious source of like a form. And you can feel that this body takes up space. You can just feel it. Even with your eyes closed, you can know it. But you also know the space you're in. You can sense that space without even looking at it. And you have a sense that this body is taking up space, and at the same time, this body is located in space. So you can feel the spaciousness of the room. Not only the spaciousness of your room, but you can feel the spaciousness of the whole building, of your room, of your apartment or your house, wherever you're at. You can feel how large of a building you're actually located in. But not only just the spaciousness of the building. You can feel how spacious your neighborhood is. It's part imagination, part felt sense of knowing the neighborhood, feeling the neighborhood. And then even further out, we can feel the spaciousness of where we're located at. And everybody on this call is located in a different space. And there's this huge capacity to feel into just how wide of a space we take up. But the important thing is to realize we can feel this. We don't have to see it. We can feel it we can know it. If the space as wide as all the places where we all live is too wide, then we can just step back to our own neighborhood. If that's too wide, we can step back to our house, the building we're in, or even closer to just feeling the room that we're sitting in, and stay there in that level of spaciousness. The idea is to begin to sense that all phenomena, all experience in life arises within space. It's held within space. And there is always space around us, around everything. But we have to practice sensing into the space that holds everything. So in this moment, right here, right now, without any expectation of getting to any place in particular, we can just begin to recognize that we are held in a much wider, vaster spaciousness. And that wider, vaster holding gives us the capacity to be with whatever. Space doesn't judge what it's holding, it just holds. It's like the sun, it doesn't care what it shines on, it just shines. So our experiences of pleasant and unpleasant can be held in this more neutral spaciousness. It can give us a gap to learn to see choice, but only if we cultivate coming into intimacy with this sense of spaciousness. The spaciousness can hold whatever memory that came up for you, whatever temperature that memory was, whatever form and shape it took itself into, and whatever level the wind is. The space can hold it all. Space itself can hold everything. It has room for everything. And the more we can cultivate the felt sense of space, the more we can cultivate a sense of equipoise and capacity to hold whatever arises. And once we have some space around it, we can choose what direction we want to go in. Keep your sense of spaciousness. If you notice the mind thinking, open to the room and the space that holds that thinking. Nothing exists in a vacuum. Everything exists within space and can be held by space. We just have to learn to see outside of the containment of our thoughts. So in a minute, I'm going to ring the bell. But some of you may not be ready to get up. So don't see this bell as a sign that something's over and time to get up. See the bell as sound. And continue where you're at. For those of you that get up, the contemplation that we're going to consider is the harm. What harm is caused by your anger? Not what harm is caused to you. What harm is caused by your anger, and see if you can feel it. We're going to look at this over the evening before we come back tomorrow. And so there's no requirement to get up to do this. You could stay here and sit a little longer. Just feel into the elements of earth and wind and fire and space. There's plenty of time to look at harm. So I'd like to see where we're at. Kind of check the pulse here. A little bit harder over the evening. I'd like you to think about where the danger is. Right? Where's the danger in this harm, in this anger, this the harm, the danger? Where is that in this anger? There is a danger to this. And it's that danger that we're going to talk about tomorrow. You can consider, you know, just your own reactivity, what happens. But until you're really beginning to see the danger that can happen if we don't learn to practice with this, I'm talking about as a practitioner. Where's the danger of not dealing with this aversion? Where is that in your life? And then the more we see it, the more we're going to be willing to uproot it. So I think that's all I have. Let me see if I can leave you with a quote. Here's another one from Ian. I fear you have not given me enough guidance. That's what the yogi said. The teacher remained silent. You left me totally on my own. Still, there was silence. I have had to do all the work myself. Again, silence. All you gave me was time to discover the truth for myself. Silence. But I guess in the long run, this was the best way. Silence. I am honored that you respected me enough to let me discover the truth on my own. That's what I'm hoping you do. Over time, discover the truth on your own about you. I just want to create the space that gives that truth permission to come in the room.